Welcome to All About APIs. On this podcast, you'll hear from seasoned API practitioners, product leaders, and architects on what it takes to successfully design, launch, and maintain APIs that unlock new growth opportunities. Hello and welcome, everyone. This is our latest episode of the All About APIs podcast. I am your host, Buddha, product evangelist at Tyke. I'm joined here by Sedki Abushamala, who is the co-host of the All About APIs podcast as well. Hello, good to have you here, Sedki.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. Thanks, Buddha.
Awesome. And joining us as our chief guest today is David Bisak from Aperture. He is the chief API officer, and we are going to be diving deep in conversation with him about all things API enablement for the digital banking industry today. So hello and welcome, David. It's really, really good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me. I really look forward to this.
Fantastic. So let's kick things off. Obviously, we are looking at the world of API enablement and what that essentially entails. Let's get started a little bit with your background. Tell us a little bit about yourself, David, and the audience as well, so that they know you a little bit better.
Sure. Hi, everybody. So I'm Dave Bisak. I work at Aperture. My role there is as Chief API Officer. And I've been in that role for about a year. But I joined the company when it was founded 5 years ago. And Aperture kind of set out as a goal to enable financial institution customers to give the best digital banking experience to their banking customers. So we're a software as a service. We host digital banking for several hundred community and smaller banks and credit unions across the country. We run their online banking, run their web apps and mobile apps. And we do this through APIs. So as our company name implies, Aperture, we do focus on APIs and digital enablement for digital banking through those APIs. So I joined Aperture as an API architect to design APIs for the Aperture API program. And at the time, my role was doing API design, architecture, some developer experience work, and various other aspects around an API program, design patterns, style guides, governance, and tools to enable APIs. I also do some other stuff in my role with Aperture. So I participate in Financial Data Exchange, or FDX, in the development of the FDX API. I sit on the API offering task force to help evolve that FDX API. And that's an industry standard for banking. And also, I've done a little bit of speaking at API Specifications Conference and published a couple blog posts. Prior to joining Aperture, I worked at SAS. I had a career there for 28 years before I retired from SAS. In the last five of those years, I ran the API Center of Excellence. So SAS was adopting APIs and building an API program there as well. And I ran a group within SAS's enterprise architecture team for evolving APIs and led the development and stewardship of SAS's API standards. We conducted API reviews across the R&D organization. And during that 5 years, we had about 120 different APIs that came through that API review process. And the goal there was to ensure consistency in the APIs and things like that. And I also participated in the design and documentation of OpenAPI 3.0 as part of the OpenAPI Technical Steering Committee work under the OpenAPI initiative. And I'd like to continue doing that a little bit more. They're talking now about OpenAPI 4 and how that might evolve, and JSON schema standard evolution, async API. All those things are going to be important to Aperture and to the banking industry in general.
Great. That's quite the journey and career you've had so far. It's fantastic. It's very interesting just to hear from you in terms of what you're involved in right now, but also what you have been involved in mm-hmm. in your past life, essentially. And just understanding, I would imagine at some point of time, you would have had to bring some of these technologies from just your curiosity to actually making it a reality of, okay, this is now part of our mainstream project line. And that's where I would imagine a lot of the API enablement stuff that we're going to be talking about comes from, where, yes, you've touched upon all of these different topics and You've got open standards and you've got different styles of APIs and specific things that go in a digital banking arena. But at the same time, people need to obviously understand the importance of it. And therefore, the adoption of that then becomes the next big step. And you need the buy-in from people to be able to make that happen, especially in larger organizations, especially in places where you're talking about the banking industry or the financial services industry in that case. So we'll touch a little bit more upon that as we go along. I think if we want to just set up the scene a little bit, because we are talking, again, we're talking API enablement for the digital banking space, it'll be really good to understand what the digital banking industry looks like today. Who are, say, the key players, the key stakeholders? Who are the, what are the different components that make up this digital landscape, digital banking landscape that we are going to be talking about today? So could, if you could tell us a little bit more about that, that'll be a really good starting point.
Okay, sure. Yeah, the landscape is quite interesting, actually. So if you look in Europe, there's an open banking initiative going on in Europe. And so there's standards that are emerging there to provide common APIs and interfaces and common data access. So bank customers always have the right to get to all of their data, and there's a standard way to do that. So there's some unifying forces in Europe that are guiding that open banking initiative, and a lot of the banks now are complying with that. And that's enabling lots of capabilities and integrations, as well as that data access that the customers really want and have a right to. There isn't really a great equivalent of that in the United States. So all the different players are pretty much acting on their own. So what Aperture is trying to do is, as I said, we're a software as a service. So we provide digital banking. So we're trying to provide a common set of APIs that now work on hundreds of bank financial institutions and credit unions. So any of our customers will have access, and their banking customers will have access to that data through the APIs that we're providing. But that's limited. That's not following an industry standard, and you can't take that those APIs and move to other institutions. There just isn't that compatibility. But I did mention FDX, and that is one area where there is some good movement in the industry, and there's a lot of different participants in FDX, both as data providers, which is normally going to be financial institutions, but it also can include insurance and investment companies and other people that have financial instruments. So FDX is building a uniform API for accessing banks, listing your bank accounts and your transactions, et cetera, creating transfers and doing the normal banking activity through a common API, but also accessing lots of other things. So being able to get tax forms and various other things related to your financial holdings. So that's really the where I see a good opportunity for the industry to come together and break up all these different siloed access. So if every bank in the country has their own API, there's almost no way for innovation to occur, right? So fintechs want to be able to build capabilities, but if they have to change their software to talk to every different API that's out there, it's going to be very limiting in what they can actually do. It's an inhibitor. So by having a common API, either like Aperture's API, which works against hundreds of banks, or something like FDX, is going to help drive better innovation and improve what offerings you can get from those fintech companies. And that's going to be a benefit for customers as well as for the financial institutions as well.
Let me ask a follow-up question there. That's a very interesting that we find ourselves in, mainly how open banking exists in Europe and not here in the States, although we have on the healthcare side, FHIR has ultimately the same goal. It's to enable open access to data. And I want to get your opinion. How come you think we don't have the same initiative with open banking being pushed here in the States?
Well, that's a great question. So without knowing what's in the minds of all of the leaders in the financial services sector, and that's banks and investment companies, et cetera, is very competition driven, and companies want to set themselves apart and be a differentiator in the space. So it's hard for them to adopt a standard API that makes them look like everybody else, right? They want to stand apart and they want to be able to do things that no one else does. But I think that is going to be moving, and we're seeing increased interest in things like FDX. So I think things are shifting, and that's going to be based more on customer demand. Just like you have it in Europe, where customers basically have a right to their data and to be able to access their banking data, et cetera. You know, we'll start to see some of that movement in the US as well. And then that customer demand is what's going to drive the providers to follow that and then probably implement some standards, whether it's FDX or other APIs.
And for the uninitiated, FDX in 30 seconds?
So FDX is an industry consortium. It's financial data exchange. And it's grown out of other efforts that have been around for a while. So there was, prior to FDX, there was OFX, which is like an open financial exchange interface. And OFX is an XML-based API. But basically, OFX would allow a third party, such, think of Intuit, like QuickBooks or Quicken or something, to be able to access your bank so that I can go from my accounting software, I can then access my bank and get a list of my transactions for the past month, import them into my financial planning software or other things. So it was a standard interface for third-party applications to talk to the banks. FDX is basically modernizing that stack. So it's a RESTful JSON web API built on top of OpenAPI, which, and you guys had Ken Lane as your guest on your first All About APIs podcast, and you talked about OpenAPI and the benefit that that brings to the industry, which is really phenomenal, I think, because it provides a standard way to describe APIs. And as Ken said, it's a way for different machines to be able to consume those APIs and be able to generate code to access those APIs, whether it's generating SDKs or generating front end or other types of interfaces. So that gives huge leverage and power. So FDX is adopting that, and they're actually structuring their API the way it was intended through OpenAPI. So it's broken down, it's split up into multiple documents, multiple source files, and you can include or reference common components from one API to another. And that's what we're doing at Aperture as well. We're using OpenAPI, and we're structuring our APIs as components. So all the elements, all the reusable schemas and things like that are all described with OpenAPI components, and we can reuse and mix and match things that way. So FDX basically is taking this path and driving things forward, and they're evolving the API to meet industry needs. So it's a living standard, it's growing. They're coming up with new releases on a regular cadence, adding new capabilities. So for a while, last year, I participated in the Consent API Task Force. And that's an example where when a third party connects to your bank on your behalf, you authenticate with your bank. And then through the Consent API, you say, I'm going to give this third party access to these three accounts, but they're not going to be able to see these other five accounts that I hold at that bank. So the Consent API is basically what you do to give a customer entitlements to specific data. And you are in control as a customer.
Sounds like OAuth. So
it's an extension of OAuth. And they use FAPI, which is the financial API model, and things like that. So they're doing all the right things there. And it's a good model for other financial institutions to look at. And even if you don't implement FDX at a specific institution, as I said, the API structure that it has and capabilities are still something that can inform the API design that you're working with. So Aperture joined FDX. There's lots of other players that are participants in FDX. So you can go to the FDX website, financialdataexchange.org, I think, and you can see all the members.
Thanks for that. So yeah, it seems that Aperture is pretty, is a very early adopter of this movement and looking to push what is the de facto open banking implementation here in the States through FTX. I'd love to take the conversation back to OpenAPI Spec. So you were an early contributor to OpenAPI Spec. Aperture is using OpenAPI Spec. There's so many different ways to use it. So in my day-to-day, essentially consulting work with companies who want to use OpenAPI Spec to build API management platforms, I find that there's so many different ways that OpenAPI is used. So is it used as design first? Is it auto-generated by introspecting the code? Where do you use it? Is it just this thing that gets built and forgotten about? Is it actually published somewhere? I'd love to know what OpenAPI Spec does for Aperture and its customers.
Right. So we adopted OpenAPI when I joined the company. That was one of the first technical decisions that we made, was to use OpenAPI to define our APIs. We take an API first approach to our development. So my role at Aperture, the primary thing that I do as an API designer and an API architect, is I gather requirements, functional requirements from our product team. They're the ones that decide what are the features we need to enable for our customers. And they write out user stories and things like that. So we gather those requirements, and that defines business domain. And we do some domain modeling and things, and we say, okay, what are the resources that the user is interacting with, and what are the operations and behaviors on those resources? And it's a domain-driven design approach that we take. So we do the API modeling, and then I create the APIs that implement those capabilities that are necessary. And then I abstract things a little bit better, because we don't want to design an API for one specific use case, for one client design that we're working on. I want to make a general purpose so that our customers can create their own experiences. So we talk about the capabilities and the resources, and we do API modeling. But I capture all that in an OpenAPI, and we design all the APIs with OpenAPI. We have another API architect on staff who works on our team. The two of us collaborate on that. And then we'd also talk to the engineers to talk about what's possible, what's not possible, et cetera. But we start with the API design. And then from there, we do code generation. And we actually do a little bit of API generation as well. So we have some tools that let us capture high-level abstractions of APIs, like a resource. And if we know we need to do basic CRUDL of this particular resource, we can feed that to an engine and say, create a new resource, and then it spits out all the CRUDL OpenAPI operations for that resource. Then we fill in the blanks, things like the definition of the schemas and things like that, and all the error conditions. But we do some code generation to generate our OpenAPI from a higher level data model. Then we take that OpenAPI, and we also use annotations. So we use specification annotations or specification extensions to annotate the API with a little bit more information. And we run it through another post-processing tool. So we take our OpenAPI source and we generate an augmented OpenAPI from that. And then from that, we generate documentation. And then we also can generate code. We generate an SDK. We can generate server-side code and things like that. And then the teams implement those stubs. They provide the implementation of the stubs that we generate from the OpenAPI definition. And as I said, we take all the OpenAPIs and generate things. We also publish the OpenAPIs. We also extract all the JSON schemas from those so that they become independent schemas. So you can use them outside of the OpenAPI. You don't have to know how to pull schemas out of an OpenAPI document. We integrate them all together and publish them out. So we do all kinds of things with those. And we're doing other things with generating mocks for those OpenAPIs. And we're looking at third parties that also provide some tooling support to automate testing based on the OpenAPI specification. We give the OpenAPI to the quality engineering team, and they build contract tests based on the API definition. And then we know that the development is done when all those contract tests succeed and pass. And then we use those as regression tests too. So as we evolve the API over time, we run those tests again. Wow. So the OpenAPI is really central to everything that we do around the API development.
That's incredible.
The benefit we get from it.
Yeah. So start with the domain, map out what the business logic needs, convert that into an open API spec, and that becomes the lifeblood of everything built around that. That's incredible. How did you, or how do you, it's an ongoing process, I imagine, change the culture so developers accept this line of work? And let me elaborate what I mean by that. So being a developer and working a lot with developers, I'm going to speak for a lot of us. We hate anything that's not writing code, right? And so we've automated this entire line of work that traditionally used to, and what you've done is you've improved efficiency, your velocity, your time to market. You've done all these incredible stuff by building automations that used to take time from developers. What is the learning curve as a developer that joins Aperture and sees, holy moly, the first 70%, the design process, the research process is now handled for me automatically? What is that like?
Well, there's a couple of aspects to that. So the first of which is, since we can generate a lot of this code and we have the middleware that handles a lot of boilerplate processing, all the boring stuff you don't have to deal with. You don't have to write the code to validate the authentication tokens, and you don't have to write the code that parses the JSON input that comes in. You don't have to write the code that validates that JSON against the schemas that are defined in the OpenAPI. All that boring stuff is done for you. So as a developer, you get to focus on the actual business logic, implementing the behavior and coding that and writing that. But we are collaborative. We do engage with the engineers and the architects when we're doing the API design, because we need to know what's possible. So if we're writing an API on top of existing software that's already there, and we have a very robust banking system that's been in production for over 20 years. So it's evolved over time. And when Aperture was founded 5 years ago, a big portion of that was this existing business unit that came from First Data Corporation, and it was a product called Funds Express. And that was an existing online banking application that was there and mature and exists already. So we always have to be realistic when we create APIs. It's not all blue sky out and completely brand new. We are building on top of an existing system, and it has those constraints. So we engage the developers and the engineers to know what's possible. But we're really giving them the freedom to implement things however they want. There's a contract that they have to abide by in order to implement the API as it's defined. But you know, they're free to implement the backend however they want, to choose their data storage mechanism and things like that, and evolve that and let that grow over time. So they still have quite a bit of responsibility and freedom in how they do their work. We're just taking away all the boring stuff.
That they don't want to work with. The interesting part is, I think if anyone's listened to the rest of the episodes of this podcast, I think everyone knows I'm a big fan of standardization. And it's not just because standardization is because I want to just keep following rules and I want to be told mm-hmm. what to do on a day-to-day basis. It's more because standardization of certain operation, like you said, the boring stuff is taken care of, and it frees me up to actually innovate, to actually go and do that exciting stuff and build on top of really strong foundations. To me, that's what standardization is all about. That's what open standards and open APIs essentially enable. And I think what you've described right now with the open API specification, it's really created this common language that can then be spoken across the entire organization. And it's unifying people towards a common goal, ideally. I think that's what the philosophy mm-hmm. behind it is, where you're encouraging collaboration and easy integration with systems as well as processes, because your underlying standards are the same. You're not trying to create something that is completely custom, which would mean that there's going to be a learning curve of anyone who's going to come in and join. And equally, if you were ever to integrate with solutions externally, then again, that's a custom connector potentially that is needed, as opposed to having an industry standard like open APIs that will enable you to do that. So which segues us nicely into, say, if you were to then get started with an organization where you are thinking about an API program, you've got developers, you've got business owners, You've got ops people, you've got your DevSecOps teams as well. And you've got a few different teams that are essentially coming together to make this API product of yours successful. So for that to happen, obviously, you need that buy-in, that API enablement that you've been talking about. So what does that process look like? So if someone is starting off thinking about creating an API program for their organization with different stakeholders in mind, how do they get started with that journey?
Right. So I was fortunate to join a company that was their mission, right? So the founders of the company had already decided it was going to be open APIs. We're going to do open banking and it was going to be API driven. So the stakeholders at Aperture were already bought in. So I was fortunate enough to come into that environment. But for other organizations, and Ken talked about this a little bit more too, about companies that are initially maybe wary of exposing their content through APIs. But really, essentially, is in today's day and age, you have to have APIs if you want to stay viable, if you want to be competitive, if you want your company to survive. You will be displaced if you do not provide APIs to enable others to access and work with you, because that's how companies grow. They can't do everything on their own. They have to partner with others in the industry. And in our case, it's going to be with fintech companies who want to be able to access the banking capabilities in order for them to solve problems for their customers. So by having APIs, you're opening up your system to that opportunity to integrate with others and to grow your business by reaching out and finding new customers, finding new markets, and enabling others to make you a partner in solving their customers' problems. If you don't do it through APIs, it's really, really tough uphill climb. And you do, as I said, you risk being displaced because all your competitors are doing this. And if you don't do it, you know, those fintechs, they're going to find someone else that they're going to partner with. And we already see this quite often. There's a lot of banks that are hidden behind the scenes, but they're providing the banking services for other companies that are doing things at the forefront. So if you're going with Stripe or something like that, you know, there's a bank that sits behind that. That's the opportunity that you can have. So one of the products that we're doing at Aperture is building out what we're calling embedded components. And these will be small little banking components or widgets that third parties can embed inside their software. So if you look at people who run vet clinics or lots of other small businesses, right, they spend all of their day working in their practice management software in what solves their business problems. But if they can access their bank directly inside those applications by embedding those widgets, they can, if they want to make a transfer or something, or they want to start a capital campaign or whatever, they don't want to have to switch to their banking online system and switch context. If they can do things within the software that they're working with all day long, then they can do that. So by us providing these components that sit on top of APIs, all of our Aperture customers, all these banks, can now extend their presence into other products that their customers use on a daily basis. And that's really the benefit of APIs. So I think to get that buy-in, that's where you have to point people to say, what do you want to achieve as a business? And in our case, it's going to be banks. What do you want to achieve as a bank? And they want to grow and they want to support their customers and give benefit to their customers. They want to improve their experiences, but mostly they want to solve their customers' problems and enable them to succeed financially. And you can only go so far if you don't have APIs where you can pull in those other partners to help them solve those problems. So in our case, that's the value proposition of APIs is growth and success and solving your customers' problems, and being in partnership with your customers is really key in that way. And being in partnership with others in the industry.
David, how much thought goes into an API monetization of your APIs? So there's many different ways to price them. A flat fee with rate limiting, pay as you go, and tiered and everything in the middle. What is that? Is that an ongoing process? What does that look like?
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of thought that goes into that. And I think we're gonna be trying out different ways to monetize this. So when we have a third party that comes in. So for example, for banks, a large value to the bank is getting a new customer, right? Onboarding and enrolling a new customer who then creates an account, and then they'll have a deposit account. And so they're gonna hold money at the bank, et cetera, or they're gonna open up a loan, and then the bank is going to get benefit from that because they'll be able to get interest and stuff. So that's a big value to a bank, is getting a new customer. Digital account opening is part of that. So facilitating that. So that would be something that would be a high value thing. So there would be a monetization tied to something like that, where every new account that gets opened is a high level business function. That would be something that would be monetized in a certain way. The other things for digital engagement and keeping your customers engaged, et cetera, would be things that you would do more as rate tiers and things like that. So when we talked about, like I said, the embedded banking capability, those embedded components add value to that third-party application because it gives a better experience to the customers. They can do more, and it's going to keep those customers in that application, which is what those application providers want. So there's benefit to that. So there would be licensing and monetization associated with using those embedded components. And that would be more at, again, a business function level. And the customer does something at a higher level of, say, creating a transfer or something like that, then there would be something that would be monetized around those types of activities. But it mostly would be a licensing fee, and it would be like a per user type fee. But there's lots of different ways that you can monetize that. But basically, it's you're always talking about what is the business value. And when there's business value, you know, companies should be willing to pay for that because they're getting business value as well. And so we're enabling them to grow their own business, et cetera. And so that's where you do the monetization. But the specific strategies on per call or tiers and things like that, there's lots of flexibility in there, and we're still figuring out how we're actually going to do it in the long run.
I think the important part that you mentioned there, obviously, for businesses, it's important to identify what business value is. The value exchange, I think, is the terminology that has come up quite a bit during these discussions, where what is the value exchange that an API essentially presents, and is it worth us putting the effort to actually build out that API in the first place? And then once you've thought about that, once you've made those considerations, then you start thinking about, okay, what does the experience associated with that look like? And I think the thing that the world is moving mm-hmm. towards a lot more, obviously, there's the value exchange, there is the user experience associated with the product itself, and then you've got developer experience that speaks specifically about the interface that the developers are with a little bit more. And in that arena of developer experience, again, or rather the overall experience of working with APIs, there are always gives and takes, I believe. And I think you do have an opinion on this, where for you, something like security of your APIs is a lot more important versus maybe how easy it may be to actually gain access to it. Not saying neither of them are less important than the other, but if you were to prioritize perhaps one over the other, then perhaps security wins over ease of use in your case, versus maybe for somebody else, it might be a little bit different. So could you speak a little bit to that as well?
Yeah, certainly. So one of the first things that I did at Aperture was to put down our basic API design principles. And these are guiding principles that help us when we need to make decisions around our APIs, help us to prioritize certain initiatives. And so those basic principles are security is number one. And then we have things like durability of the API, ease of use, conceptual integrity, consistency of the API, extensibility of the API, and then things like completeness and robustness. So if I can create a resource, I should always be able to delete a resource. So you have common patterns. And then developer experience is also one of those principles. So we keep those in mind, but when we have to make a decision, we go back to these principles, and that helps guide us in those decisions. And as I said, security is always first. we're doing banking, right? We're dealing with people's money. So we know that security has to be foremost in everything that we do. It's not a question of if, but when. We know that bad actors are out there and that APIs are the significant attack vector. Those bad actors are going to be attacking the APIs in order to try to break them, et cetera. So we take it very seriously. But fortunately, I think it's not really a bad trade-off because, first of all, our customers expect it, whether it's the bank customers or it's the banks themselves, they're going to expect this level of security and they're looking for it. And they're getting very smart in doing that analysis. So they're aware of things like the OWASP top 10 for web apps, but they're also aware now of the OWASP API security top 10. So they know what all those things are. They know what Ebola attack is and things. So we know that they know of it. So we have to be able to speak to it and how our APIs account for security. So everything is authenticated. All of our operations clearly are authenticated. And we have a very good middleware that deals with and verifies those authentication tokens and things. And we have a very robust entitlement engine on the back end. As I said, this has been in production for 20 years. So that entitlements engine is very robust and very tested, and it's very secure. So we rely on that. But as I said, it's not a huge trade-off because more and more companies and their APIs incorporate that API security into their design. So people are seeing this and it's becoming a standard that this is how you design APIs. That you do have to account for security in the design. So you have to be careful to think, for example, don't use auto-incrementing integers as your resource IDs, because that allows someone to probe and say, oh, you gave me resource 545. I'm going to try 546 and see if I can access that. I can try 547, try to access that. Those types of things are very, very blatant and easy to identify and fix. And people are expecting that now. So the trade-off isn't really a hard one to make. You start with security up front. And we try to do is shift left as much as possible. So we do security analysis of all the API designs at the beginning. And we play scenarios and things. And one of the things we did at Aperture was we held an API security hackathon. It was an internal thing, but we just basically turned everybody loose on the APIs and said, try to break it. And we actually found a couple of things that were subtle. And we've also worked with vendors, and there's a number of vendors in the API security space. And we've found some vulnerabilities there that were also very subtle, but we were able to close them. So knowing about that is really important. And then you do things like when you define your APIs and your JSON schemas for your payloads, adding more precise constraints to those schemas can really help, because when you're taking your API request and if you're validating the request against those schemas, you can reject invalid requests all the time. And that's where you get things that where people are trying to attack your thing by sending in really long strings, seeing if you can break the system and stuff like that. So you can prevent a lot of things by adding really good tight constraints. But that has a really great benefit too, because it provides a better model both for the consumers who are using your API. They know what you can pass and what you can't pass. And it also helps with code generation and helps with even at the database level. So you can put column constraints on your database. So you have multiple tiers in which you're validating and applying security. So I think it's not a hard trade-off to make, but it's an important one to always put security first, and then things fall from that. And the way things are built, especially with code generation and things, it's not as onerous for the consumer to follow and use a secure API.
And I think we are in the world today as well, I think on our end as well, like just thinking about what we are doing on a day-to-day basis with API, with Tyke as an API gateway or API management platform as well. I think that's where security is so at the forefront, pretty much most conversations that we tend to have, where of course mm-hmm. we want to manage APIs better, but we want to make sure that things are being done in a secure, scalable, and stable manner. So that's the three S's that you almost get started with, especially if you are having these conversations with us. And I think security, and the important part to consider with security, like you were mentioning, it's also quite dynamic in nature as well, because your security needs could change, the security trends could change, and you need to be in a position to be able to adapt to that. So like you said, the hackathon, like you ran, if you were to do that on a more regular basis, you might find out more vulnerabilities and be able to tackle those as you go along. And at the same time, with perhaps a product like Aperture, or maybe product like Tyke, perhaps with the flexibility that it brings to the table when it comes to just having those security protocols and methodologies readily available to you for adoption, I think that also makes a big difference, because you don't want to be stuck in a world where you've already made such a big investment into specific platforms and then your needs have now changed and you're no longer able to keep up with those changing needs. And that's where having that flexibility with solutions can be quite beneficial. So I don't know if you've got any final thoughts or final nuggets to share with the audience before we call it a close for today.
I think in closing, it's one thing that people might ask is, what's one thing that people get wrong when they build an API program? What do they forget about doing? And I might cheat with that and say, maybe there's not one thing that they get wrong, but if there's one thing, maybe it's that they don't do the 5 or 10 things that you should do. So, but that is a cheat. But I think the biggest thing that I would recommend, and from my experience, is don't do it all on your own, right? There's a lot of industry experience out there. There are a lot of experts. So be willing to learn and change and learn and see what others have done. So attend conferences. Watch these podcasts. So your All About APIs podcast. Ken Lane has his talk show, Breaking Changes. Eric Wilde has a really good series on YouTube, All About APIs. I've talked about how I've been to the API Specifications Conference. That's really a good resource, but there's other conferences like API Days and things like that. So be active in the community. And lean on others, and don't be afraid to stand on the shoulders of, learn from others and what they've done, and look at those experience reports and things like that, because having those different perspectives is really what's going to make you a better engineer, a better architect, or even a better business person. And also, I mentioned attending conferences, but I really do encourage and act on this is put in a request. Fill out a call for speakers or whatever, submit something, present at a conference, because teaching or presenting is a great way to solidify your knowledge and ask questions. And you will learn more in putting together a presentation for others than you would have otherwise. So it's a great way to grow and learn, and then also make connections in the industry as well. Find out people that you can work with. And then you can communicate and collaborate with others. And that really helps you grow as a person, and it helps you build an API program. So learn from others and make the best of it that way.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you so much.
If David, if I figured out how to send 2 transactions at the same time and double spend, would I get richer keeping that to myself or reporting it to you?
It depends. So it depends on whose platform you're working on. You won't be able to do that with our platform.
Dang it. Never mind.
Great. On that note, thank you so much, David. This has been a fantastic conversation. And thank you so much, Setki, of course, for the wonderful questions to go with it. So this was API, All About APIs podcast, everyone. This was all about API enablement for the digital banking landscape. So hope you enjoyed that session. Thank you so much once again, David. And until next
time. Thank you.
Take care. Thanks for listening to this episode of All About APIs, powered by Tyke, a leading cloud-native API management platform for the modern stack. So come, empower your teams and put your devs in the driver's seat. If you want to find out more, visit us at tyke.io. And until next time, take good care of yourself.